All right, then we continue with a series of implementation issues. And I give the floor to Katrina.
Good morning. Today in Agenda Papers 12, we have a series of, I suppose, narrow scope amendments or annual improvements to discuss with you. I suppose they fall under two main areas. The first is the proposed narrow scope amendment to IAS 40 on transfers of investment property, which we'll cover first. I think we're actually going to cover all papers in order, which is a novel idea. And then we're going to discuss the annual improvements package 2014 to 2016, and there's sort of three amendments to that. And we've got the due process paper to support those. And then finally, we've got a due process paper that supports the proposal to have an exposure draft on annual improvements for 2015. So with that, as I say, we'll start with papers A and B, and I'll hand over to Denise.
Thank you, Patrina. Good morning, everybody. Agenda paper 12A provides an analysis of 57 comment letters that we receive on the exposure draft transfers of investment property. We published this ED in November 2015, and at today's meeting, we are bringing a summary of the recommendations from the Interpretations Committee. So the exposure draft proposed a clarification of paragraph 57 of IS 40 relating to transfers to and from investment property. So most respondents broadly support the proposals. However, some of them requested further clarification, and we discussed those requests in paragraphs 11 to 21 in the paper. And this paper also discusses transition. And in that respect, we received some mixed views about it, some noting that a full retrospective approach will be a bit too onerous for some transactions. So our analysis regarding this aspect of transition is in paragraphs 24 and 28 of the paper. So the Interpretations Committee recommends the board to finalize these amendments. However, it recommends also adding some further clarifications and revisions to the wording as shown in paragraphs 29 to 31 of this paper, and also you've seen our proposed amendments in Appendix A of the paper. So we would like to ask the board just a couple of questions after paragraph 31 of this paper. Does the board agree with the Interpretations Committee's recommendations to finalize the amendment and the proposed revisions? And the proposed revisions to the wording of the proposed amendment. Those are the two questions. Do you have any comments or?
I agree with finalizing this amendment. However, I have a little fear about the wordings and the change you have proposed, especially about changing paragraph 57A, the development. Adding the development with the view of the owner's occupation. This is exactly the same wording to the 57B. Uh-huh. However, I don't think this environment of 57B and the 57A would be different. In the case of 57B, this is the change from investment property to more liquid assets. However, in the case of 57A, which you are proposing now, is the change from the investment property to more illiquid property. And actually, you are saying that only the management intent does not really make sense. It cannot be the evidence. This is very good. However, once you made such a small development on your investment property, you can argue that this is the evidence of changing the use of investment property. And I think this could lead to some abuse because, say, look at the current environment. We had a break exit and lots of new construction for investment property seems to be a little bit slow down. And then in that case, sometimes people may think is if we could put some development saying that this is a construction for dormitory or this is a construction for our office building or something. Then they could avoid kind of a fair value measurement of investment property, and that this kind of motivation is possible if an entity has a will. So I'm just would like to know what kind of discipline can we introduce? I mean, so we have a tainting rule in the IS 39 about the investment for the maturity, but because it didn't work, we remove it. It's fine, but this is the situation a little bit similar to the situation like IS 39 held for maturity. We need to put some rigor. Say, for example, if the entity arguing that this development is for own use and the developing it, but if they didn't really start using it, how do you penalize that? That's it, my curiosity.
Well, first of all, we're talking about discipline. I think that we introduced here two important changes to include that discipline. First of all, well, in changing use occurs when the property meets or ceases to meet the definition of investment property. So I guess that entities will have to look carefully at the definitions of property in IFRSs and make sure that the property meets that definition or not. And then the second change is that there should be evidence of that change in use. And well, you've got a point that the examples of evidence, they are too broad here. But we try to follow the previous wording that we had already in this paragraph. Some respondents, they ask us to provide more specific examples. However, we thought that they could also be misinterpreted, and that's the risk of making them a little bit more specific. So in our view, we decided to leave them as broad as they are here, and introduce that discipline or that rigor just with the with the amendments that we have made in the first paragraph of 57. So the examples should be taken just as examples.
Okay. So then the wording, the intent is not the evidence. This is provide good discipline.
Changwu.
Thank you. I agree with the steps of recommendation. Just a minor comment, clarification on the transition. On page, maybe this is 620, no. Paragraph 27, we are offering one full retrospective application or a kind of a, this 27B is a prospective approach you are saying, right?
Yeah,
is it different from the typical prospective application?
Well, it's what we are introducing, let's say B double I would be prospective for them. Well, okay. What we are saying here, we cannot categorize it as prospective because it's not, the way we are describing it is not the way it's describing IS 8 exactly, because asking is that entities do a reclassification just to make sure that all the property at the date of initial application of these amendments is categorized in the right category, in the right place. And then after that, then they're going to apply the amendments prospectively to new transfers.
So it's kind of full current period retrospective catch-up.
Sort of a catch-up.
Catch-up the application plus prospective application.
So
it's kind of special application.
Yeah.
So why do you think this is a good idea to give all option to of the A1B? So I'm saying, by default, in principle, apply the retrospective application. However, if some kind of problem is a hindsight or error or some kind of blah blah blah, then you can use different alternative. But that's the typical paragraph on every standard. But you are saying just either A or B. You can choose anything. So that's one concern.
That's right.
Another one is B is another concern. If you just explain to us.
Yeah, that's right. Well, as we explained in the paper, it's just that we received mixed views about transition.
Mm-hmm.
So some people thought that retrospective application was good,
mm-hmm.
that was our original
right.
proposal
yeah, that
in,
was
in the exposure draft. However, some people thought that it was too onerous, and they or that they could do retrospective application, but they would apply hindsight. So we made an assessment of what would be the effect on the entities depending on the types of property that they were holding. So we are saying some entities would be already applying the principle as it is. Well, the principle as we are showing it, the principle of transfers of property, they would already be applying it in the right way. So for those entities, there is no real effect. However, there could be some other entities that could hold different types of property that would involve a change in the measurement of the property. So changes from cost to fair value or vice versa. And for those entities, finding those values could be a little bit complicated without the use of hindsight. So that's why we are offering a choice. Mm-hmm. And this is not new. In recent standards, we have been offering choices. In IFRS 10, in IFRS 15, many other standards. This is not new.
I think it's hard, just to say, Chung, it's fair that when we exposed this, as we said, it was exposed with full retrospective application. And at least I think the way I start when we look at it is to say there needs to be a reason to allow something other than a full retrospective approach, because that's our mainstream approach in IS 8. And I suppose to feed off what Denise said, there was one particular example expressed in some comment letters that at least I was sympathetic to, in a sense, in saying that it could possibly be onerous. And it was where you, in the past, potentially had a transfer from investment property, you were measuring your investment property at fair value, and maybe quite some considerable time ago there was a transfer to owner-occupied property. In that scenario, if you had been applying the requirements in paragraph 57 almost very strictly as written, you know, not as we're proposing, you could at least in theory have to go back quite some years, work out exactly the date of the new transfer, work out fair value at that date, and then rework your depreciation forward. And at least for those entities that have that fact pattern, I think we were more sympathetic to thinking that requiring a full retrospective approach in that case, you know, potentially could be quite onerous. But equally, we quite liked the Interpretations Committee decision to not just therefore say have a perspective, but also to have that sort of date of transition reassessment of the cast classification, because without that, actually, you could have had some properties that would have ended up being sort of locked in to a different use from how they were being used at that date. Mm-hmm. So I suppose we thought the combination of that sort of catch up and perspective was a reasonable balance.
Gary?
Thank you. Like the others before me, I agree with finalizing the recommendations as the staff presented and issuing the document. Just a couple of comments leading, I think, just to one question is, in paragraph 21, the IC recommended we try not to define what a change in circumstance is or what substantive evidence is. I actually wrestle with that a lot because I think here's a case we probably could define it fairly precisely. But in the end, I'm coming down to agreeing with the Interpretations Committee, because the minute you define something, anything that doesn't fit the definition presumably is out of scope or is an alternative or something. So I think the Interpretations Committee's got that right, but I have thought about that on and off, you know, since this came up through the IC.
Yeah.
I also agree that we should emphasize judgment is a part of this, where we are, but really is judgment backed up by actions, not words, because I've always, you know, worried about management intent being the dominating characteristics. I think here we're coming down, once you say it's judgment, well, it's my judgment, the answer is, but it's judgments backed up by actions. Something has to happen. And I think we need to emphasize that either the standard itself or the basis or both in it. And then lastly, and it's on the actual wording on page 9, under 57A, and Tock was right about needing some rigor built into this thing, because you could say, okay, commencement of owner occupation, okay, that's an action, or of development with a view. Well, development is, you know, presumably it's more than thinking about it, and maybe it's more than hiring a consultant, you know, to study it. I mean, the question, I think it's, what do we mean by development? I don't know if we have anything we can put into the document or into the basis that we've learned, or we just emphasize back to its judgment backed up by substantive actions, and recognizing any action can be reversed, but I don't think, we don't want to write this for anti-abuse. I think we write it for, you know, people who are trying to good faith doing it.
Darryl?
So I also agree with where the staff is heading with this. I also specifically agree with the changes that the Interpretation Committee suggested to the transition requirements. And I think, Petrina and Denise, when you were answering Chung Wu's questions, you were quoting what I think is paragraph 26C, which talks about the two reasons why the Interpretations Committee got to that, which was firstly that the complexity, and secondly the need to use numbers in hindsight, which I fully understand, fully agree with, and I'm comfortable with where you've got to. We've recently had a discussion at the board table around first-time adopters and the fact that in many circumstances first-time adopters are using similar standards currently to what is required in IFRS. And my understanding is particularly IS 40 is often a similar standard to IS 40 is often used. So I was just perhaps wanting to ask and then suggest that we look to the first-time adopters. We've chosen, as I understand it, not to give them relief. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the issues in 26C are just as applicable to first-time adopters, unless I'm misunderstanding something. So the first question is, am I misunderstanding something, I guess? And the second one is, should we not be considering that relief as well in that circumstance?
Maybe I'll make my comment while the staff's thinking about that. I wanted to sort of follow up a little bit from what Chung Wu was talking about, which was on the hindsight point, and just a suggestion. I think what the staff have got here and from coming from the Interpretations Committee is sort of not a conditional choice between full retrospective and the sort of more prospective-ish transition approach, so I don't think we'd want to sort of say you can only get in here if. But I think one difference between this and some other places is the reason why we've got this relief isn't so much about how onerous it might be, which is more the logic we had, for example, in IFRS 15, but more to do with the risk of hindsight. And given that, I wonder whether it might be a good idea from a drafting perspective to make it clear that if you use the full retrospective approach, you can only do so if that doesn't involve the use of hindsight. Now, I'm not saying do that, I'm saying could you have a think about it? And the reason why I'm not saying do that is because I know there's a reference to IAS 8 here, which already has concepts of hindsight in it. But I also think, don't have the bound volumes here, but I also think that we have got precedent recently of situations where we've said explicitly you can only do things retrospectively if it doesn't involve the use of hindsight. Given that we've done that in some standards, I wonder whether it's a good idea to be explicit here that you can only use the full retrospective approach if it doesn't involve the use of hindsight, just to be clear.
How would you do that? I mean, how do you say, you mean the evidence from hindsight, I mean, the information's there, how do you prove you didn't use hindsight?
Because some of them, I think, have already applied this approach. Yes?
Yes.
Some of them have already read this interpretation of IAS 40, yeah. So in a sense, I've already done it, so they've already got all of the information.
Yeah. I
think it is possible, depending on facts and circumstances.
And I think depending on the previous transfer there happens, there's some particular transfers that wouldn't need the use of hindsight, in a sense. The ones that do are potentially where you were, you know, moving, you know, fair value was being sort of stopped at some point in time.
But
previously.
I certainly think we wouldn't want people to be doing it if it was using hindsight anyway, so I thought that I was just sort of stating what we were doing. Just a drafting point, I wonder if we've got this sort of catch-up approach in 27B, whether in the draft we need to say explicitly that you need to do an opening retained earnings type adjustment to get that to work from a mechanical perspective.
Okay.
Then some people have been talking about discipline around these transfers, and I don't disagree at all with what they're talking about, and I think it's going to be a case where we're going to want people to have good evidence and for the auditors to be checking they've got good evidence and they've applied it well. I guess my only caution is, given the scope of this and the fact that it was sort of a clarification and a tidy up, I'm not sure how much extra we want to add in the context of these changes, given that we must already have some of these questions, even with these transfer requirements that were already in IAS 40. Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just going to say, if the reason that we were proposing change to the two examples, to A and D, was simply to be responsive to some concerns that were raised. I think the original question came in was particularly around property under construction. And the question or commentary that came in was, many people felt that if we had just left A to D exactly as they were, they at least predominantly look like they apply only when properties are completed and not to properties under construction. So all we were trying to do was tweak it, you know, to stay within the sort of wording and language of how those examples are worded, but make the examples apply more often to situations where property could also be under development. So certainly we were only trying to do something subtle, not change things dramatically. I mean, I think if, as a board, for example, you feel very uncomfortable about the changes in 57A, and you think if we were to do that, we need to write another three paragraphs to put rigor in, then I'd suggest it would be better simply not to do it and leave A as was.
Amaro.
Thanks, Hans. Just one additional point. I do agree with staff's proposals. And coming back to Chen Hu's point, I think there's one aspect that Patrina didn't touch, and I think it's particularly important when it comes to interpretation. So the origin of this clarification is exactly the lack of clarity. So I think to even support the proposal in 27B, we should remind that this is the result of the inconsistency in application of the standard due to the lack of clarity. And we accepted that since we proposed it to clarify. So I think it's one important aspect, and I would suggest this to be included in the basis as well, because then we acknowledge that we are being sensitive to one aspect of the standard that was not clear, that has not clarity enough, and then some people might have interpreted in a way that we do believe was not the appropriate way, but we cannot simply impose a full retrospective approach to them because of this.
Martin.
A more question, but also to 27B. I mean, if then they're using this reassessment of the classification, do they have to provide disclosure then they have done this reassessment, and what are the results of that, or is it seen as a reclassification and then the usual disclosure come into play? That is my question, because I agree that we should give this relief, but I think then at least we should have some disclosures if people then have tons of properties reclassified and only have seen that in retained earnings, but not any disclosure that it has happened, because prior year is not adjusted. I think we need some. Or is it seen as a reclassification and then the usual disclosure comes into play, which we, I think, have in IAS 40 when you reclass from investment to question?
Let us look at what's disclosed. I think it's a good point that maybe we could take it away. I think that maybe what we can take away is, let's have a look at what IS 40 would require as disclosure. If IS 40 would already require you to give information about that day one reclassification, that would
work. But then we should change the wording. Then we should not say it isn't reassessment, it is then reclassification, because otherwise this disclosure will not come into play.
Yeah. Otherwise, by the way, if somehow we think the existing IS 40 disclosure doesn't cover it, then we should put in a specific transition disclosure too.
Like what?
To come first, I fully agree with the Su's ideas to interpret this from hindsight point of view. I think it is quite critical. And secondly, about how to enhance the rigor, I agree with the concern from Tucker. And for me, you know, relate to A, 57A, a more, you know, rigorous evidence is government permission, planning permission. Particularly if you are talking about material project, and it will be take a time to apply and get permit. And it will not like what you say, you know, the after vote and company announced they will change. It gets permission, apply a permission, it will be a long time process. And then it will be a, you know, rigorous evidence of one of them. I'm not sure whether
the interpretation committee once discussed from that point of view, that angle. Because for me, you know, commencement of own occupations and development with a view to own occupations are both quite softer than, you know, planning permissions.
So there was no particular discussion on that?
Well, when we brought the Common Letter Analysis to Interpretations Committee, there were some very specific examples suggested by respondents, and I think one of them included something along the lines of what you're saying. But again, you know, there was not much appetite among the members of the committee to include very specific examples because they might not be applicable to all entities in the same way. Even there was an idea at some point to remove completely the examples in paragraph 57, get rid of them, and just leave the principle there. So,
Daryl?
So I think with some help, I might be answering my own question from earlier. So the end of paragraph 28 said something along the lines of, this consistent with IFRS 1, which does not include an exception to or exemption from the requirements of IS 40. Paragraph 30 of IFRS 1 actually allows you to do a deemed cost.
Exactly.
And that in fact, to my mind, is a bit of an exception from IS 40. But in providing that exception, what it does is makes this then redundant, I think, for first-time adopters. So I withdraw the question.
That was very efficient. Can we vote on the staff's proposal?
I'll just add
you have heard a couple of points for improvement.
A couple of maybe only one modification, but let me tell you. So it's our recommendation, except around transition, we would say a fully retrospective approach applying IS 8, but clarify as long as that does not involve the use of hindsight. Mm-hmm. We will look at and ensure that any reclassification that happens, if people do take the sort of alternative transition approach, any reclassification that happens on that day, we will ensure there's disclosure around that. And I think that's the two main.
With these
changes,
minor alterations, who can vote in favour?
All in favour.
Right.
On the discipline points that people were raising, there was some chat around that at the Interpretations Committee as well, some discussion of that. So in the basis, presumably, we can talk about the fact that you need to have appropriate evidence, etc., right? Because I think that would help some of the board members.
Yeah, the plan, just to tell you, is that these changes in use have to be supported by observable actions, because there was a discussion around that.
Yes, so regarding observable actions, just quickly. So if you say it's a development for own use, then if the occupation did not start after the completion, so for a couple of years, what kind of action can auditor take? I mean, yeah, that's the point. And actually, these things may happen. So that's the point I wanted to raise. So therefore, if you write something in the basis, so therefore, the development should be followed by the real occupation. That's the point.
Okay,
Denise, then the due process steps.
Yeah, thank you. Well, let's move on to agenda paper 12B, which sets the due process steps that the board has taken in completed the narrow scope amendment to IS 40. So we have some questions at the end of this paper as well. So I'm going to ask you one by one, and if you could please tell me if you agree or disagree. So does the board agree not to re-expose the amendment to IS 40?
All in favour.
Does the board agree that the effective date of the amendments be 1st of January 2019 with earlier application permitted?
All in favour.
All in favour. Does the board intend to dissent to the amendments? So any of you, do you intend to dissent?
It's the board as a whole. It's
oh, no.
So is the board satisfied with completion of the due process steps applicable so far? And can we start balloting the amendments?
All in favour.
Thank you.
Okay, you can move on to the next issue, annual improvements.
Yeah, we're going to move on to 12C, but it's Denise again. Thank you, Denise.
Okay, Agenda Paper 12C provides a summary and analysis of the comment letters we received on the proposed amendment to IFRS 1. This amendment contained a proposal to delete the short-term exemptions in paragraphs E3 to E7 of IFRS 1 because the relief in these paragraphs had served its intended purpose. So most respondents broadly agreed with these proposals in the exposure draft. However, some respondents requested some further clarification, and those requests are discussed in paragraphs 16 to 31 in the paper. So we recommend finalizing the proposed amendments to IFRS 1 subject to the proposed changes described in paragraph 43 of this paper, and we are asking the board whether it agrees with our recommendations. We also note other issues raised by respondents and discussed in paragraphs 32 and 36 of the paper. In particular, paragraph 36 of the paper explains that if we take particular steps when developing short-term exemptions, we think that we should no longer need to expose the deletions, the deletion of those exemptions when they expire. So do you agree with finalizing this amendment, and do you have any further comments?
Mary?
Just a comment about your analysis in paragraph 24, I think it's 24, issue 3, paragraph 30 and following, the argument that these should be made permanent because of hindsight concerns. I agree with the staff's conclusion not to make them permanent. But I have a feeling, and I'm sorry I hadn't had a chance to look it up, that in IFRS 1 there's a general assumption that a well-planned adoption to a transition to IFRS allows you to collect the information that's necessary. So I think one of the reasons we should explain in the basis that these short-term exemptions do not need to be made permanent is because of that assumption, and the places in which we have put in, we collectively, the short-term exemptions are when a new requirement is being introduced, and if somebody was a first-time adopter in a short period of time, they wouldn't have had the notice they needed to collect that information. So I think it's important because, in contrast with the hindsight comment that Sue made on the previous issue, this is explaining why we can impose requirements without it running afoul of hindsight. And so I think we should deal with that in the basis, explaining why we did not take up the suggestion on making those permanent, because people can overplay hindsight risks.
Any other comments? Can we support the staff's recommendation?
All in favor?
All right.
Yes. Okay, so Agenda Paper 12D continues to discuss proposals in the 2014 to 16 annual improvements. The paper deals with the clarification of the scope of the IFRS 12 with respect to held for sale interest. A summary of the issue that led to the proposed amendments, along with those amendments, are described in paragraph 5 to 7 of the paper. The board has received 47 comment letters. And with respect to the proposed amendments to IFRS 12, almost all respondents agree with the board's proposal. Two respondents disagree and suggest that the board reconsider and specify only those disclosure requirements in IFRS 12 that are specifically relevant for held for sale interest. And we call this issue 1 in the paper. Our analysis on issue 1 is included in paragraph 13 to 18 of the paper. On the basis of analysis, we recommend that the board reaffirm its proposed amendments. If the board wishes to review the disclosure requirements for held for sale interest, we think that it would be appropriate to do so when it conducts a PIR on IFRS 5, which the board has tentatively decided to do. Question 1 on page 6 asks whether you agree with this staff recommendation. And we'd like to take a pause here and open the floor for discussion on question 1.
I think that we agree with staff recommendation.
One comment.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Thank you, dear. So everything is good. I agree with your recommendation. However, there is a kind of some maybe issue with the paragraph 5A and paragraph B17. Some commentator has suggested that this is a kind of B17 is redundant if you add paragraph 5A. So this is a kind of repetition of there was a B17 before, but we are adding 5A now. So what do you think about that redundancy of the B17?
Yes. Thank you for raising that point. I think your point is included in Appendix A,
yes.
Paper.
Right.
And we consider whether we should keep paragraph 17B or we should, you know, delete it because we now have a paragraph 5A. But as described in Appendix A, proposed approach, we think we wanted to make changes as little as possible in order to avoid any unintended consequences. And if you look carefully what's in paragraph B10 to B16 and what's in paragraph B17, B17 specifically talks about an exemption on summarized financial information that is included in B10 to B16, and one could argue that some of the disclosure requirements in B10 to B16 is not necessarily related to summarized financial information. For example, for example, paragraph B10, little a, requires a disclosure of dividends paid to non-controlling interest, and one could argue that that is not related to summarized financial information. And we do not want to cause any change in practice or any change in amendments. And what we wanted to do is just provide a clarification around the scope of held for sale interest.
That's the case. Maybe we need to provide some kind of explanation why we include B17 in addition to paragraph 5A.
Thank you. Okay. In the basis.
Yeah. Gary?
Yep. I also fully agree with the staff recommendations. Just one, someplace, maybe it's the basis, just a wording clarification. I appreciate to some extent bounded by earlier words, but it worked. The idea caught me as reading paragraph 1 and 7 together. We say it held for sale interests, but as I read paragraph 1, distribution to owners doesn't strike me as a held for sale interest, and a discontinued operations may or not be for sale but could just be for shutdown or runoff. So there's some place in the basis, and we say this be clear, held for sale is broadly defined to include, yep, getting rid of, because the distribution to owners is not a sale by, I don't care how we want to.
Yeah, I think just to let you know, hopefully that won't be a problem in the drafting, and that we've used this sort of held for sale interest in the paper simply as shorthand in the paper, because we were referring to it so often rather than write very long-winded sentences. So that phrasing, held for sale interest, I don't anticipate us using
in
the drafting.
I just wondered, that was not something that hit me.
No further comments. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
All in favour?
Okay, now moving on to the transition requirements. Again, the board also received wide support for the proposed transition requirements. However, we have identified three issues with respect to the transition requirements, and we call them issues 2, 3, and 4 in the paper. Our analysis on these issues is provided in paragraphs 24 to 34 in the paper. On the basis of analysis, we recommend that the board reaffirm its proposal to A, require retrospective application of the amendments, and B, not provide any transition relief for the amendments. Question 2 on page 9 asks whether you agree with the staff recommendation. And we will ask you whether you agree with the recommendation on the effective date when we discuss agenda paper 12F later, the due process paper. Now I'll hand it over to the board for discussion.
Maru.
Thanks. Question on your argument in paragraph 33. So we say staff says that an effective date of 1st of January 2017, so in 6 months' time, would typically give more than 1 year because it would apply to the 1st of December 2017. But how about quarterly and interim reports in 2017?
We looked at the requirements in IS 34. And there was only one specific instance where you would be required to follow some of the disclosure requirements in IFRS 12, which is when you become or cease to become an investment entity during the annual reporting period, you have to provide a disclosure in IFRS 9, which required to explain why the change and some quantitative disclosure requirements. And we thought there was only one instance of that requirements that could affect the interim financial reporting. And other than that, IFRS 12 disclosure requirements, we thought it would generally apply to the yearly financial statements. So for those entities that would be that would become or cease to become an investment entity, it could be less than 12-month time period. But for the other broad range of entities, this would typically give those entities more than 12 months.
So there's basically no interim disclosures?
Yeah, so it's only in that one situation where you become an investment entity that there would be interim disclosures. Otherwise, we think IFRS 12 only applies to
IFRS. Yeah, I would suggest this to be clarified in the basis, because this can strike in some jurisdictions that I know a couple that do require full report in 30th of June 2017. So there might be some jurisdictions that might be affected because they are not interim reports or quarterly, they are full financial statements.
Yeah, hopefully if you had a June year end, hopefully you have even more time, at least if you're only applying these requirements, because we'd say it would be for annual periods beginning on or after January 17. So if you had a June year end, actually, you would only have to apply first of all.
No, I do understand that, because this jurisdiction that I have in mind particularly, they do require application of full IFRS.
Okay.
So that's why I'm particularly not only suggesting, because we didn't comment on interim or quarterly reports in the paper itself. And I think it's important to clarify this aspect in the basis. And for this being clarified might help in some jurisdictions just to avoid some unnecessary discussions among.
Martin.
Which is issue 3, I think I have some sympathy with what people have said, because man, I think really if this entity is already disposed of, and then what will happen with the retrospective applications, and they don't have to disclose at the current year end, but for the comparatives they have to do all this disclosure, and I think that is burdensome and doesn't give a lot of information, and therefore I would say okay, we should give this transition relief, because I think we have the change, and it was unclear, because when the situation was unclear, they would not have given that. Now we change it, but then to make that change for comparative years, I think is a little bit of not so useful. So I would give this relief, because I think to have that then collect the information and do it then only for comparative years for an entity which is already disposed of in the current year does not make a lot of sense.
Mary?
I general observation, but maybe can I ask the staff a question about Martin's observation first? It seems like the interpretation committee considered Martin's comment, but I didn't know if the staff had anything to add or if you wanted.
Well, for this issue, we took this directly to the board because these proposed amendments stemmed directly from the board's discussion last year, rather than by the interpretation committee discussion.
Okay. So maybe that. Okay. But it is part of the annual improvement cycle, right? My comment was, if this were a standalone amendment, I think I would support the staff's analysis about effect. Sorry, this is solely about effective date, my comment. I would support the staff's analysis, although you have to think through it. And at first, I thought, that seems awfully close. But then, you know, as you explained why it made sense. But something that goes beyond this cycle of AIPs is I worry that we put things together in an AIP and call it one set of changes, but then people can adopt it bits and pieces. You can early adopt, you know, item one, but not item two and item three. And I think that contributes disproportionately to the perception that I4S is always changing, because somebody is adopting not just, they could be adopting the AIP cycle, one thing early, one thing when required, and then different transition methods. So I think we should be doing more and more to package AIP as a single package, not just for consultation, but you adopt it or you don't. Having said that, that's not our style now, but I am concerned that we're growing the problem by having not just different transition methods, but also different mandatory effective dates within a single package of AIP. So while I agree with the staff analysis about this issue on the whole, I'd rather keep a single effective date, mandatory effective date, for all of the items in a single AIP cycle. So I would push it back a year for that reason. Yeah. And, you know, would say separately, maybe ask the staff to go away and think about whether we should continue to be as flexible as we are about AIPs, because it does mean that you have bits and pieces coming in. You know, one AIP with three items can lead to, I don't know, I think it's probably nine variations of which, you know, which version of I4S you're applying.
Yeah, and I suppose I'd only say at this stage that I think our starting point, by the way, is always to think there almost needs to be a good reason to move off having the same effective dates. And in this instance, we thought there was enough argument to move off, you know, it just in the interest of having this come in sooner that rather than later, but certainly it doesn't have to be.
You know, if it's AIP, the world has lived without it for the time it's taken us to do the process, so I wouldn't, I'd overcome that concern and just say do it all together.
Sure. I agree with Mary's observation at a philosophical level. I think we just need to expose stuff on that basis, because I could see circumstances where, so we could hear people's feedback, because I could see circumstances where there could be a package of AIPs where some provide relief and some are going to be viewed as a pain in the neck. And so some people might want to be able to early apply one thing that fixes a problem but need more time to do something like provide extra disclosures. So I think we'd need to have published something on the basis of our proposal is if you're going to early apply, you have to early apply this entire package. So we can feed that into the mix.
I agree with that, and I wasn't suggesting that for this cycle of AIP, but it's thinking about that makes me say don't vary the mandatory effective dates. In this one.
Could I just add one other thought into that? It'd be worth thinking through this problem a little bit. I mean, the only thing to bear in mind, of course, is that these amendments go into each individual standard, into each effective date. So therefore, actually, in a funny sort of way, potentially there's a risk of creating some additional complexity, because although we think of it as a package, we issue it as a package, they actually, you know, the effective date has to be put into each individual standard. So when you start making connections between them, it could also start getting complicated as well.
I only say exactly what I would say. If we are talking about AIP related to old standards, you know, suggestion from Mary is totally right. But I think some of the AIP related to, you know, tricky of the minor amendment to a newly established published standards, which will be effective within 2-3 years. And then maybe, well, our decision is this amendment should be fit into the original decided effective date or other decision. So I fully agree with the panelist's comment.
Can we support the staff's recommendation?
Eleven in favour.
Finally, we have summarized in Appendix A to this paper other issues and suggestions raised in the comment letters along with our proposed approach to them. Do you have any questions or comments on these?
Which paper are you doing?
12D, Appendix A.
No, that's not the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Agenda paper 20E is about a proposal to amend IS-28. The ED was intended to clarify the accounting related to exemptions from applying the equity method in paragraphs 18 and 36A of IS-28. Many respondents fully agree with the proposals in the ED because they clarify that an entity elects to measure investments in associate and joint ventures at fair value through profit or loss on an investment by investment basis. However, some respondents comment that the clarification appears to be inconsistent or conflict with other standards, IFRS 10, IS-39, and IFRS 27. Some respondents suggest additional disclosures or more clarity. Some other respondents disagree with the proposed transition retrospective application. Let me start with the first issue. The first issue relates to inconsistency with the investment entity requirements in IFRS 10. The board considered this issue when developing those requirements in 2012 and 2014. We think that nothing further needs to be done in this respect in the context of the amendments being made to IS-28, because these amendments are clarifying in nature. We agree with our analysis.
Yes, that's the case.
The second issue explores a possible conflict with IS-39. Based on step analysis in paragraphs 32 to 33 of this paper, we think a venture capital organization or other qualifying entity applies only the measurement requirements in IS-39. It does not apply the requirement in paragraph 9B of IS-39 when determining whether to measure investments in associate or joint ventures at fair value. Consequently, we think that an amendment is not needed to IS-39. Do you agree with our analysis?
That is again the case.
Okay. The third issue relates to a possible conflict with IS-27 relating to the preparation of separate financial statements. In particular, it touches on how to interpret the term category in paragraph 10 of IS-27. We explain in paragraphs 40 to 44 of this paper why we think we do not need any amendment or clarification to IS-27 in this respect. Do you agree with our analysis? I will now take a number of issues together, issue number 4, 5, and 6 in this paper. Issue 4 is about disclosure requirements. We think that additional disclosures or exemptions from existing disclosure requirements are necessary, as we explained in paragraph 48. Issue 5 is about further clarification of the amendment to paragraph 36A. We recommend expanding the explanation regarding the amendment to paragraph 36A in the basis for conclusions, as described in paragraph 50. Issue 6 is about transition. we support retaining the proposed retrospective approach, as explained in paragraphs 58 to 60. Do you agree with our recommendations regarding disclosure, the amendments to paragraph 36A and transition, which are questions number 4, 5, and 6 in the paper?
I agree, but have a specific comment and a general observation. The general observation is, not only for this batch, but for the ones you just went through, I think all these points of analyses are quite good, and without making the basis for conclusion a monster, it would be quite useful to capture working through why we do not see these as conflicts. Yeah. So just capturing some of the analysis from the paper and the basis in summary form. And the second is on the specific comment, your question 5 about issue 5. I'm fine with what you had proposed in paragraph 50 of the paper, but I thought it should be that specific, a response to that comment, because I think I didn't know whether the comment that was received that's teed up in paragraph 49 was literally a request for this, or whether it was a question for a more generic discussion of how the consistency requirements in ISAID apply. I think paragraph 50 is appropriate as a response to this comment, and I'd say let's just limit that comment to this, and not leave a hostage to fortune of another kind.
Doc?
Thank you. About the issue 6, you are saying that the entity would not use the hindsight because there is IS 53. Is this all reason that you believe the entity will not use hindsight, because we have discussed the hindsight issue in other topics?
Not using hindsight is based on IS 8.
But only the paragraph 53 says that you entity should not use. So if that is the case, say for example, the HG account, basically we do not allow retrospective because of the risk of hindsight. And that this issue is financial instrument. And that's similar risk we can see. So how would you cope with it? Do you totally depend on the IS-853 only?
I think, does this come back to a similar question we had earlier, that obviously when we did this analysis we were saying it's okay just to refer to IS-8 because we've got paragraph 53, but perhaps similar to the vote on IS-40, we might want to clarify that, so we might want to say it's retrospective, applying IS-8, and actually say, but assuming no application of hindsight.
I do worry every time we flag it explicitly that we undermined IS-8. But at a minimum, I think if we mentioned it in the basis to remind people of the concept, I think that might be helpful.
Because that might actually work best here, because what's quite good about paragraph 53 is it tells you what to do or how far back you can go, in a sense.
We should remind ourselves that if we start doing that, in every base for conclusion from now on, we would have to mention this. So we can't miss, because I've learned that along the years, that if we cut a paragraph, if you cut a work, or if you do not include, I can see inside here. So we have to think about this.
Chang-Wu.
Thank you. I agree with all the recommendations. However, on question 6, many of our stakeholders are suggesting thinking about the retrospective application. So they are suggesting prospective application, many stakeholders. There are some reasons why they are suggesting to think about their prospective application rather than retro, because this is a kind of a losing some comparability if we use retrospective application. That's why the, some stakeholders suggested that this might be conflict with the IFRS 10. But our requirement is correct. Existing requirements are, we knew that this is a kind of a different requirements from the IFRS 10. But one comment on this issue six is many national stand setters and stakeholders are having the similar concern if we just insist on retrospective application. So what do you think about that, that suggestion?
Some respondents, yeah, I think they concerned about, as we discussed, hindsight. So, but if we say specifically or in the basis for conclusions, I think it, we can avoid that risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, can we agree with the staff recommendations?
All in favor?
So, but the sorry, finally we recommend rewording the amendment to paragraph 18 to avoid any risk of misunderstanding and to be consistent with the proposed wording for paragraph 36A. The proposed wording is set out in appendix A. So does the board agree with the final question? Does the board agree with our recommendation that it proceed with the amendment to IS-28 along the lines of what is included in Appendix A to the paper?
Well, I don't think we have any choice.
The other recommendations.
Subject to balloting,
yes.
Yeah.
All in favour.
Okay, thank you, Julian.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Your first time, I believe.
Yes.
And I'm immediately going for the due process. Please.
And so, yes, agenda paper 12 first. So, annual improvements 2014 to 2016 cycle includes amendments to three standards, IFRS 1, IFRS 12, and IS 28. We set these out in agenda paper, appendix A of the paper. And these have just been discussed in agenda papers 12C, 12D, and 12E. Agenda paper 12F sets out the due process steps that the board has taken completing the annual improvements 2014 to 2016 cycle. The questions we have for the board are set out on page 6 of the paper. I'll just go through each of these one by one. So the first one is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation not to re-expose the amendments within the annual improvements 2014 to 2016 cycle?
12.
All in favour.
The second question is, does the board agree that the effective date of the amendments to IFRS 1 and IS 28 is the 1st of January 2018, with the earlier application permitted, and for amendments to IFRS 12, this is the 1st of January 2017?
Do we want any more discussion on that? I don't know, because I know it came up.
Mary raised
the point. I don't support this because I think they should all be the same date.
Okay, who can support this staff recommendation?
11 in favour.
Okay, question three is, does any board member intend to dissent to the issuance of the annual improvements 2014 to 2016 cycle?
That's not the case.
And the last question is, is the board satisfied that the due process requirements have been met and that it's undertaken sufficient consultation analysis to begin the balloting process?
All in favour.
Now move on to agenda paper 12G. Which is the due process paper for the annual improvements 2015 to 2017 cycle. So the annual improvements 2015 to 2017 cycle includes amendments to two standards, IS 12 and IS 23. The amendment to IS 12 clarifies the presentation of income tax consequences of payments on financial instruments classified as equity, and the amendments to
IAS 23 clarify what happens to a specific borrowing once the construction of a qualifying asset is complete. Agenda Paper 12G sets out the due process steps the board has taken in completing the improvements 2015 to 2017 cycle. In the paper, we recommend a comment period of no less than 90 days. However, as noted in paragraph 9 of the agenda paper, if this exposure draft is published together with any other proposed narrow scope amendments, the actual comment period may be longer to ensure that a similar comment period for all exposure drafts published together. So I want to move on to the questions on page 4 of the agenda paper.
And to, I think two things. One is, looking at these two alone, I'm not sure that I would say go ahead with doing a whole AIP cycle for these two things. If we have a couple of narrow scope amendments that it makes sense to batch them with, then I'd say go ahead, but I'd say my preference would be to say kind of tentative approval and then see what else we have in the pipeline, because if we don't have something else, then I wouldn't do it. And the second is, regardless of when we get to the point that we have critical mass, shouldn't this at least be the 2016-2018 cycle? Because as far as I can tell, we're in 2016 now and we're talking about issuing the ED. So that's the minor point.
Well, see.
So I'd give permission to ballot, but say if we've only got these two, hold it.
You would not issue this on its own.
No.
Yeah.
Is anybody in the world dying for these amendments that we're aware of?
They have resulted from submissions to the interpretation committee.
Well, Henry, if you didn't do these on your own, what would you do, bundle them with?
I think narrow scope.
I think there's a couple of narrow scope amendments that the reason we even thought about this and asking you about the comment period is that there is a proposed narrow scope amendment to IS 8 around changes in accounting policies that this potentially could go together with. There's another potential narrow scope amendment that the Interpretations Committee are recommending to you that you'll see in the September-October timeframe, and just around IS 16, which would be very narrow scope as well. That, again, if you agree, then that might be something.
So with the understanding that we're looking for batching opportunities, questions to the board? The comment period?
Yeah, so does the board be the comment period?
All in favour?
Does any board member intend to dissent from the issuance of this board again? Is the board satisfied with due process requirements being met in the balloting process?
Well, that brings us to the end of the session. I propose we stick to the timetable because there are some other meetings going on in between. So we'll meet again at 2:00.
Okay.